KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. If you were hoping to tally the progress that grew from the ashes of the violent backlash of George Floyd's murder 5 years ago, you might come up short. A number of Native activists, community leaders, and even tribal officials say any momentum from what appeared to be a major reckoning for race relations at the time has since mostly stalled. We will assess this milestone in the timeline of racial justice today, and that includes some shining examples of positive change. That's coming up right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Bison are being restored to tribal lands across the Mountain West and the Great Plains. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Rachel Cohen reports, a herd manager in Colorado is playing a big role.
A few bison jumped into a grass-lined trailer. They were heading to the Kiowa tribe in Oklahoma. The bison are part of two herds that live in mountain parks owned by the city and county of Denver. And the city gave these 10 away so the Kiowa tribe could start its first herd in over 150 years. Bison were hunted to near extinction in the 1800s. Rick Williams is Oglala Lakota in Northern Cheyenne and was at the bison transfer in March. He says it included a ceremony and a song for a safe journey.
The buffalo were a sacred animal to us. We knew that they provided all of our economy and our lifestyle and everything that we needed to survive.
Denver's donation is part of a larger effort to give surplus bison from conservation herds and national parks to tribes to restore cultural and environmental connections. Over the past 7 years, Denver has given 140 bison to 10 tribes. That includes the Northern Arapaho in Wyoming and the Northern Cheyenne in Montana. I'm Rachel Cohen.
Carol Pickett Hull was remembered at an Anchorage memorial ceremony as someone who was more than an athlete. She also worked hard to build the Native Youth Olympics into the success it is today. The Inupiaq athlete died at the age of 61 at her home in Seward on May 5th. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, friends and competitors alike say she embodied the spirit of traditional Native games.
Carol Pickett Hull was only 5'4", but became a giant in her sport when she set a new world record for the one-foot high kick at the 1989 World Eskimo Indian Olympics. That's when she jumped with 1 foot to kick a tiny ball suspended 7 feet in the air.
Tiny little powerhouses.
That's how Nicole Johnson described herself and Carol when they met as teenagers.
There's nothing that could stop us. Our height, our weight, our ages, nothing stopped Carol from doing what she loved to do.
When she won the 1 foot high kick, she was asked if she wanted to go for the record. She had this infectious excitement. Yes.
Reggie Jewell is a 10-time gold medalist in the blanket toss. He says Carol and her teammates came along at a time when men dominated the games, but that soon changed.
They were coming onto the scene with this energy, but also with this hunger.
A hunger for the strength and spirit of their culture, which Carol tried to embody. Her 1989 record would stand at WIO until last year, when Emily King, a Canadian from Whitehorse, would surpass Carol's record by an inch. A memorable moment for Greg Nostein, a longtime competitor and game official.
Carol was out there being her biggest fan and said, "You can do it, you can do it."
Over the years, Carol Pickett Hull seemed to be an endless source of encouragement. She coached, she officiated, and became one of her sport's biggest cheerleaders. When she first entered the scene, the games were held in small gymnasiums. Today, the statewide Native Youth Olympics draws thousands of athletes and their fans, a reminder of how a little encouragement can go a long way. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And on this day in 1838, the infamous forced march of thousands of Cherokees from their land began, a 1,000-mile trek towards Oklahoma that became known as the Trail of Tears. U.S. troops were armed with rifles and bayonets, and many Cherokee died from starvation, illness, or hypothermia. The estimated 25 million acres they were forced to relinquish in the southeast were taken by white settlers. You're listening to National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing millions of dollars of scholarships to Native students every year. Applications are accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND.
Support by the Arctic Encounter Symposium, North America's largest Arctic policy event at the Denaina Convention Center and Anchorage Museum, July 30th to August 1st in Anchorage, Alaska. Registration for this global conversation at arcticencounter.com.
Support provided by First National Bank Alaska, offering a one-solution, tailored approach to meet the financial needs of Alaskans by providing banking services, loans, investments, and more to help shape a brighter tomorrow. Learn more at fnbalaska.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. The U.S. Department of Justice is withdrawing its oversight of the police departments in Minneapolis, Phoenix, and Louisville, among others. The original oversight was a result of the DOJ finding civil rights violations in how police interact with Native Americans and other people of color. The announcements come as the nation marks the five-year anniversary of the murder of George Floyd that sparked nationwide protests. Those protests initially sparked a historic reflection at all levels of U.S. society on race and justice. Those reflections have been replaced by the elimination of diversity initiatives in business and education and federal civil rights investigations into alleged discrimination against white students and employees. What is your assessment of progress in the 5 years since George Floyd's death? You can join our conversation today by calling in at 1-800-996-2848. That number again, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from Minneapolis, Minnesota is Mary Lagarde. She is the executive director of the Minneapolis Indian Center. She's a citizen of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe. Mary, hello and welcome to the show.
Hello.
Joining us from St. Paul, Minnesota is Dr. Yahuru Williams. He is a distinguished university chair and professor of history and founding director of the Racial Justice Initiative at the University of St. Thomas. Yahuru, hello to you as well, and welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And joining us also from Minneapolis, Minnesota is Reverend Jim Bear Jacobs. He is the program director for racial justice at the Minnesota Council of Churches. He's a member of the Stockbridge Muncie Band of Mohican Indians. Reverend Jacobs, welcome to the show. It's good to have you as well.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
It's great to have all of you on the air. And Mary, I want to begin with you. The protests that followed George Floyd's murder, they forever changed the Twin Cities. It became the center of what appeared to be a global reckoning over race relationships. 5 years later, what are Minneapolis residents saying about the impact of these events?
Let's see, 5 years later, you know, it's been a journey, you know, for our community and for the city of Minneapolis. And, you know, in 5 years, you know, I know that, you know, community is still saying that that we need police, but at the same time, there are also other ways of patrolling our community and keeping it safe. And, you know, it's been our community that really has stepped up to do that. So working, you know, alongside Minneapolis police and other law enforcement to keep the community safe. So, you know, I think in the past 5 years, you know, there has been progress made, you know, and especially with just rebuilding those community, police community relations.
You mentioned the importance of community involvement, rebuilding relationships. Mm-hmm. How about meaningful systemic changes since then that have occurred in the city? Can you cite any?
Yeah, I can. You know, so One thing that I've been a part of since the murder of George Floyd has been the Unity Community Mediation Team. And so that particular team, they had organized back in the early 2000s and came together, and it really was about creating those systemic changes with law enforcement, particularly with Minneapolis Police Department, around use of force and community relations and behavioral health. And so it was after the murder of George Floyd that mediation team came back together. I hadn't been a part of the original team. At the time, there were other representatives in the early 2000s that had been a part of that within the Native community, including the American Indian Movement and then the Metropolitan Urban Indian Directors. So when I came onto it, that really was, right in 2020. And so over the last 5 years, I've worked alongside, other community organizations and organizers, along with Minneapolis Police Department to revise the Memorandum of Understanding that they had originally signed back in 2003. The work that we did, it took about 2 years, a lot of listening sessions, just a lot of community meetings and, hearing from people and what they wanted to see with transformation with Minneapolis Police Department. And, in that, so we do see, the changes with recruitment and diversifying the workforce with behavioral health and how MPD is responding to community, and state and cultural awareness practices, duty of care and accountability. So that definitely I see as part of the systemic change is the adoption of the current Memorandum of Understanding with the Unity Community Mediation Team. And then within that too, we have been able to develop other ways that community members, if they want to file a police complaint, there are trusted Native organizations in the community that have stepped up and are the ones that are taking those complaints, so that community members can go there. One is Little Earth Residents Association, and the other one is the Indigenous Protectors Movement. The last thing that I would say on the systemic change, it was just a couple weeks ago, April 29th, April 30th, we had a number of shootings here in the South Minneapolis community that left five of our young Indigenous people killed. It was after that the mayor of Minneapolis, the chief of police with Minneapolis, came and met with the Metropolitan Urban Indian Directors, which are all the directors, of the Native organizations in Minneapolis and in St. Paul, and came to meet with us to talk about those shootings just to get our feelings on it, help with increased enforcement, just law enforcement presence in the community, because there was a real fear of retaliation within the community. So I think that, just having, rebuilding those community relations with Minneapolis police and, having them, come to the Urban Indian Directors, that has just been something that's just really important moving forward with the community.
Mary, you mentioned the fear of retaliation, and I'm interested in learning mm-hmm. more about these organizations who assist with Native people who want to file police complaints. Does that have mm-hmm. to do with a fear of retaliation? Because you could just go to a police precinct and file a complaint, but
What is the advantage of going through one of these partnering organizations?
It's about trust. A lot of our community, we're still rebuilding that trust. Some haven't had that trust, with law enforcement. And so having those organizations, the organization at Little Earth and then the Indigenous Protectors Movement, those are trusted organizations within our community. I think that just having those available, it just provides like another option, otherwise.
Sure.
How often are people really going to walk into a police precinct and file a complaint, but having these trusted organizations in the community, that really provides another avenue, for community to be heard.
Mary, the Department of Justice, the consent decree with the Minneapolis Police Department, that really put the full weight of the federal government behind the message that law enforcement needs to be held accountable. What do you make of the announcement this week that DOJ is withdrawing from that agreement?
With that, just from my understanding, I believe that there would have been federal resources that would have been made available to help to implement the consent decree. And without that, we don't have the federal resources, but we still have the state. So there is an agreement between the city of Minneapolis, MPD, and the state of Minnesota that was very similar to the consent decree. And then we also have, our agreement, our memorandum of understanding between the Unity Community Mediation Team and the City of Minneapolis, Minneapolis Police Department. And so I feel like, those two living documents, those really covered much of what the federal consent decree did. And I believe that things will continue to move forward.
All right, we're going to take a short break, Mary. When we come back, I want to ask you, a little bit more about how the city and some of these local agreements will follow up, because the city has made that promise before to improve police reforms in Minneapolis. So I'm going to ask you that, but we have to take a short break, and we have the phone lines open for any interested listeners who'd like to join the conversation. Maybe you live in the Twin Cities and maybe you are familiar with some of these events in Minneapolis. Maybe you've been involved in some of the events surrounding the murder of George Floyd 5 years ago. We'd like to hear from you. 1-800-996-2848. There is a dizzying pace to the ongoing changes to how the federal government interacts with its citizens. A number of service cuts that originally made headlines have since been restored. We'll get updates on federal cuts that affect education and low-income services and get a perspective from Alaska Senior Senator. That's on the next Native America Calling.
My name is Tammy, and I'm a member of the Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawa Indians. Smoking gave me heart disease. I used to think of cigarette smoking as something that only affected me. Then at just 44 years old, I had to look into my mom's eyes on the way into emergency heart surgery and tell her, "Mommy, I promise I won't make you bury me." My tip is, think about the people in your life who love you. They go through the pain too, maybe even more than you do.
The people you love are worth quitting for. You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the CDC.
Thank you for listening in today to Native America Calling. We're looking back over the 5 years since George Floyd's death to assess the progress or lack of progress in racial justice that was so much a part of the uproar from that tragedy. You can join our conversation by calling in at 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-99-NATIVE. Our first guest, Mary Lagarde, is in Minneapolis, where she is the executive director of the Minneapolis Indian Center. And Mary, I want to ask you about the city's pledge to follow through with its own police reforms in absence of the DOJ consent decree. That promise has been made many times in Minneapolis in the past. What do you see the city doing in order to bring about some of these changes that really were the result of the George Floyd protests 5 years ago?
Mm-hmm. Let's see. So, you know, I think that, you know, so I'll just go back to the Unity Community Mediation Team and the work that's been done there. You know, one piece of that that the mediation team in the city and MPD worked to implement has been a mentoring component, and that mentoring component is for new cadets that are coming in. And so, you know, we have recruited community members, community leaders, in all of the ethnic communities here in the city of Minneapolis, including the Native community, to be mentors, to be those ones that, are meeting with new cadets and telling their story, talking about community. And so, I think that, with the launch of that mentoring program, I think that, having that, and then some of the other items, that I mentioned with the memorandum of agreement with Unity Community Mediation Team, I think having those in place will definitely help to move things forward. But, again, it really comes down to, the accountability, follow through. And so with the mediation team, I know that every month, the team is at the table with the Minneapolis Police Department, going over, the document, how are we, in compliance, with all of those items, what is not in compliance. And so I think that, just keeping that, having that, and continuing to work on that, is really important. And just being able to sustain it, oftentimes, we see when people leave positions, that sometimes we have to start over again. And so I'm hoping that, now, there are about, I think not quite 600 officers now. Prior to 2020, there was about 900. So it's really important that we maintain the numbers that that the city has with law enforcement, but continuing to do the work that the mediation team has laid out, and then the state of Minnesota with their agreement.
All right, thank you, Mary. Mm-hmm. Let's now bring in Dr. Yahuru Williams in St. Paul, Minnesota, distinguished university chair and professor of history and founding director of the Racial Justice Initiative at the University of St. Thomas. And Yahuru, I want to talk more about DOJ's withdrawal of federal oversight in Minneapolis. Do you see this as a setback for racial justice?
It's a major setback for the city of Minneapolis, and consistent with what we saw during the Trump administration's first term in office, where the administration terminated a pending consent decree in the city of Chicago. The reason that's significant is that even though there is a Minnesota Department of Human Rights consent decree that the city of Minneapolis is currently negotiated with the state, it only covers violations connected to Minnesota human rights legislation. It doesn't cover the big pieces related to what we call constitutional policing, First Amendment violations, violations of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, violations that would be associated with the Americans with Civil Disabilities Act. And the reason that's significant is that in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd, there weren't only allegations of police brutality and violations of Minnesota human rights law, but violations of First Amendment protections here in Minnesota with regard to how the police surveilled community. Significant allegations about other abuses that would fall more under the kind of rubric of constitutional violations. That's why there were so many in community organizations like Communities United Against Police Brutality, the Minnesota Justice Research Center, and others who were really hoping for the potent 1-2 combo of both a state human consent decree based on Minnesota human rights, which we have, and that federal consent decree that would have dealt with constitutional policing. Now that we only have one, I think the real concern in community is how do you maintain momentum and accountability? Yesterday, in the aftermath of the announcement of the federal government withdrawing or asking a federal judge to withdraw the consent decree, you had Mayor Fry say that the city intends to abide by what was laid out in that 169-page document. But for those in community, and for me particularly as a scholar, this is part of the problem. The city can make that pledge, but where's the accountability? That's why we needed a consent decree to begin with, because those things weren't being abided by in the city of Minneapolis. More importantly, if we think about this broadly in terms of the historical implications of it, it's a longstanding problem within the city. This conversation about dealing with police brutality, particularly toward people of color, African Americans, Black people, and Indigenous people. In 1975, in another moment of reckoning following the beating of a woman by the name of Willie Mae Demings and the shooting of a 13-year-old boy, Arthur Cunningham, the head of the NAACP here, declared and made national headlines for declaring that the Minneapolis police had declared war on Blacks and Indians. That's a direct quote. People sometimes forget the American Indian movement begins in Minneapolis, basically mirroring the same work that the Black Panthers had done in Oakland around police brutality. But AIM also recognized that police brutality was simply the tip of the spear, that the police and kind of communities of color being over-policed and under-protected really emanated from a fundamental denial of the human dignity of Blacks and Indigenous people.
Yehura, what are the answers then? Because a two-year investigation by the Justice Department during the Biden administration found that Black and Native people are routinely discriminated against by Minneapolis police. This complaint by the public and activists has followed Minneapolis police for decades. What do you see as hopes now that there will be some change in direction?
You really would have to reimagine policing around the model of public safety and acknowledge the historic roots of policing in this community. Minneapolis police are formed in 1867 in the aftermath of the Civil War. And what people often forget in terms of how that calculus works is that a big part of their mission was basically policing Black and brown bodies, Indigenous people and Black people. A model of public safety would re-examine two fundamental questions that go into how we think about policing in this country. Who is the public and what counts as safety? Mary spoke to some of this earlier when she was talking about challenges within the Indigenous community, certainly challenges that impact all communities. When you send police out, for example, to deal with a mental health crisis, you can't expect them to have the tools at their disposal necessary to address that type of a call. And when they come out with a culture which historically has been or has seen people of color as problems, has denied their kind of fundamental humanity, what you get are these encounters that often replicate the violence that we saw visited on George Floyd's body. I think what's unfortunate with regard to Indigenous persons in our community in particular is the invisibility of this problem as it affects the Native community. The reality is that for generations, for decades, going back to the 1860s, 1870s, there are these longstanding stories of violence against Indigenous people, stereotypes that grew up in support of the police department's unequal, unfair, and brutal treatment of Indigenous people. And even in our contemporary moment, some cases that are, you know, currently being investigated by the department that have raised questions from community about the continuation of a culture that continues because it hasn't dealt with this reimagining necessary of policing to a model of public safety, to still lean into some of those stereotypes. So in order to really get at, you know, sometimes people talk about this in terms of defund the police. That's not the language, and that's certainly not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about reimagining a range of interventions that would move away from a model of policing where the police are the answer to everything to a model of public safety that would jettison this kind of foundational model of policing that began with, in this community and many others, this being about policing and maintaining the color line.
Yohuru, we heard Mary a few minutes ago mention that the number of officers has decreased significantly there in Minneapolis over the last few years. What's that the result of?
Well, a couple of things. I think in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd, there was a drop in morale and a decline in morale among the officers within the department, because who at that point wanted to be associated with the most notorious police department in the country? In fact, if we think about the global reaction to the murder of George Floyd, Minneapolis became kind of, for lack of a better term, synonymous with the brutality that we saw that occurred against George Floyd. At the same time, there were those within the department who resisted and who were opposed to the types of reforms and the transformative change that many in community were demanding at the time, kind of uncomfortable with this desire for culture change, which, again, has a long history here. Back in the 1980s, there was a police chief in Minneapolis by the name of Tony Boza, who dubbed officers in the department thumpers because of this kind of brutality that was rampant within the department. And there were those who have grown up in that culture who were unwilling to give that up. And so you had the police union, for example, Bob Kroll, offering a full-throated defense of the actions of Derek Chauvin and the other officers involved in the killing of George Floyd. And you had others within the department who simply, you know, believed that if they weren't going to be allowed to police in the way that they had historically done policing, that they knew better about what community needed, that they didn't want to be a part of the department anymore. So I think those two things worked in tandem. And I think also the enormity of the work in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd, the fact that not only was there the stigma attached to the department, but the fact that you still had to deal with, in that moment, the COVID pandemic, concerns about rising crime, and the stigma associated with the department and the inability of the department to root out that brutal culture, which had become synonymous with the Minneapolis police.
And also another interesting development, the Minneapolis newspaper, their Star Tribune, just wrote about efforts on a number of fronts to rewrite the narrative of the George Floyd case. There's even high-level calls to pardon the police officer convicted of the murder. How do you counter that?
Well, this is the problem with, you know, our work. I'm currently working on a documentary and part of a project entitled Overpoliced and Underprotected that looks at the history and privileges the importance of establishing a narrative that addresses the deep historical wounds that really are the foundations for how we got here. And these efforts, for example, to rewrite that encounter in documentaries like The Fall of Minneapolis, which insists that George Floyd's death wasn't caused by Derek Chauvin's knee, but was caused by a fentanyl overdose, so on and so forth, are not only inaccurate, but they ask people to suspend disbelief in terms of what we all witnessed with our own eyes. To be clear, if not for the cell phone camera footage captured by Darnella Frazier, George Floyd's death may have gone down in the records of so many deaths of Black and brown people in this community as the official account that was offered by the officers in the aftermath of that encounter. And when people go back and look at that police report, it is in no way bears resemblance to what we all witnessed with our own eyes in terms of that cell phone video, the 9+ minutes in which Derek Chauvin, with willful regard for George Floyd's humanity, continues to place his knee on his neck. Having said that, narratives are important, and it's important for all of us to understand. I think the Black and Indigenous community share this understanding. My good friend Jim Bear Jacobs speaks very powerfully of this. Wounds produce narratives, and so the stories that our communities tell about police brutality, about unfair treatment, about a denial of justice, ultimately come from a place of experience. These aren't things that we made up. These are actually the lived experiences of people in community. And what Mary spoke to, and it's very important, the reticence of community at times to engage with police, It often comes from the fact that when those challenges are presented, they have historically rarely been treated with the urgency, with the respect, with the dignity that people in community deserve. So their encounters with police tend to begin with the assumption that the police aren't there to serve and protect, they're there to control, and there's no expectation that they're going to receive the same treatment that someone who is not Black or brown would receive.
Here it is, 5 years later. What do you see as the long-term legacy and historical impact of the George Floyd protests?
I think it's threefold. I think one will be always the linking of that moment with the global racial reckoning around issues of equity, fairness in policing, and then, quite frankly, the backlash against it. There is a temptation in the United States in particular for Americans to always want to write our history as a tragedy with a happy ending. We like everything wrapped up in 30 minutes or less with commercials, and we like it to be a simple progress narrative that says that this terrible thing happened and now we're better off and things are moving in the right direction. We saw that in the aftermath of the American Civil War, and the reality is within a decade you had the Hayes-Tilden Compromise and the end of Reconstruction, which gave way to Jim Crow, and then almost 50 years of unequal treatment that then had to be corrected by a civil rights movement. And then you had 50 years that followed that of backlash. So this desire for, same thing could be said for women's rights. You know, women get the right to vote with the 19th Amendment in 1920, and yet we're still talking about pay disparities and all types of inequality for women, and specifically for women of color. So our desire for a tragedy with a happy ending has led people to lean into this narrative about Minneapolis being a space transformed. There are signs of progress, but the reality is that this is not a space transformed, that it's a work in progress. And I think people really need to lean into what the late Congressman John Lewis talked about in his final letter to the American people, which was published in July of 2020, shortly before his death, in the New York Times, where he said, "Together we can redeem the soul of America by getting in good trouble, necessary trouble." People focus on the good trouble, necessary trouble, but they miss the other parts of that article where John Lewis said, first and foremost, people have to understand that in a democracy, the vote is the most important change agent or tool that you have. You have to use it or you can lose it. Mary mm-hmm. spoke to this. There's a mayoral election coming up this year in Minneapolis. The chief's three-year term is up. Regime change could literally mean the end of a lot of these reforms and these efforts. And so that's important.
Okay.
And then secondly,
we're going to have to take I'm sorry, Yehuru, we're going to have to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Challenges to societal harmony abound. Trauma, depression, addiction. In Native communities, these challenges affect nearly everyone. The Native American Social Work Studies Institute educates social workers for careers to address the needs of Native communities. You can be part of the solution as a peer support worker, community health worker, or a counselor with culturally relevant training from the Native American Social Work Studies Institute. Info at online.nmhu.edu. New Mexico Highlands University supports this show.
Support by AARP. If someone asks you to buy gift cards to pay off debt, it's a scam. Imposters will claim your social security number's at risk, or your utility company will stop service due to late payments, or you won the lottery and only need to pay some upfront costs. They'll say the fastest way is to buy gift cards and share the numbers on the back. Anyone who tells you to pay a debt with a gift card is a scammer. More information on gift card scams at aarp.org/giftcards.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's AMERIND.com.
Support provided by Alaska Growth Capital. The North Slope Marketplace is now open. Arctic Slope Regional Corporation shareholders and descendants are eligible. Applications are available at alaskagrowth.com under Marketplace. Support for this program provided by ConocoPhillips Alaska, operating in Alaska for more than 50 years and valuing the opportunity to partner
with Alaska Native communities.
We're glad you're tuning in today to Native America Calling. What progress and healing have you seen in the country's racial divide in the past 5 years? We're marking the 5-year anniversary of George Floyd's death. You can join this conversation. Call us at 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-996-2848. We've got the phone lines open. Currently, we have Dr. Uhuru Williams on the line. He's the founding director of the Racial Justice Initiative at the University of St. Thomas. And Uhuru, I want to bring Reverend Jim Bear Jacobs into the conversation here in just a moment, but we had to go to a quick break there. And I want to let you go ahead and finish your thoughts there. You were talking about how in the United States, we always see, or we always want to see, our tragedies with a happy ending. Go ahead and finish your thoughts.
Just very quickly, and I think probably Reverend Jacobs will speak to this because it's something that, quite frankly, he's talked about at length in our work together here in the Twin Cities. But, you know, this idea that whiteness needs to be innocent, and there's this desire to sanitize what happened in 2020, to make it all about the actions of Derek Chauvin, to this just be about a rogue cop in a department that can be reformed without dealing with the what I like to call 6 degrees of segregation, the other disparities that contributed to what happened at George Floyd Square at 38th in Chicago on that day in 2020 that extended beyond police brutality, access to housing, access to places of public accommodation, the social determinants of health, unfair labor practices. They all come together in what we saw play out at George Floyd Square on that day. And when you think about the group of people who lined up to plead for George Floyd's life, they were all women and people of color. I think it says a lot if we think about that moment as being bigger than police brutality and kind of a snapshot of where we are in the United States with regard to some of these really big issues and how innocence isn't the metric, a happy ending isn't the metric we should be aiming for. What we should be thinking about is how do we really lean into this work and tackle this, which has become even harder now given the political climate in the nation.
All right. Joining us now from Minneapolis, Minnesota, we have Reverend Jim Bear Jacobs, Program Director for Racial Justice at the Minnesota Council of Churches. Reverend Jacobs, I want to thank you again for joining the show, and please share with our listeners your role in advancing racial justice causes there in Minnesota.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, and very honored to join with Dr. Williams and Mary Lou Gard, both individuals doing incredible work. I serve as the program director for racial justice at the Minnesota Council of Churches. And I was in this role prior to 2020 when George Floyd was murdered, but this role was reshaped and took on new direction almost immediately after the murder of George Floyd. And what we have developed is a program that simultaneously focuses on Minnesota's American Indian community as well as Minnesota's African American community. And we develop our program around three epicenters, that being truth-telling, education, and ultimately reparations. And ultimately what we are looking to do is give platform to Minnesota's or members of Minnesota's Native and Black communities to just tell their truth about their interactions, be it political systems, be it religious arenas, civic engagements, give opportunity for truth to come out, truth that is often intentionally overlooked and erased. We also ask our member denominations to take a hard look at their own history and their relationship with whiteness and white supremacy. You know, many of our churches in Minnesota are over 150, 160 years old, and when I speak to these churches, what I tell them is when white supremacy was built and constructed in Minnesota, the architects of white supremacy were sitting in the pews of these churches. And that is a history that that these congregations have to wrestle with. And ultimately, what we are asking is that our churches would commit significant portions of their budgets and assets to making reparations to Minnesota's American Indian and African American communities. And
And what do you hear from these? What do you hear from these churches? What's their response when?
Well, you can imagine a full spectrum of responses. Everything from the call for repair is just too big. There's really nothing that can be done. But we have heard over the last 5 years as this work has gone, and we have heard less and less of that. And we have had a number of churches do the difficult work of looking into their own history, who were the politicians and the social elites that were sitting in their pews, you know, as Minnesota, as an institution, was being created. Doing historical land work, like when does indigenous land become legal property, and how does it then transfer to a minister or a congregation? How are the treaties outlined? How were they violated? That kind of thing. And we have a number of congregations that have heeded our call to actually designate portions of their budget to racial justice and reparations work. And very pleased to say we have at least a couple of congregations that are in rather serious conversations about how they might relinquish legal ownership of their land or assets to indigenous nations or organizations.
Mm. Reverend Jacobs, you mentioned truth-telling and just people coming out and sharing their stories, sharing their experiences. What are you hearing from Native people now in Minneapolis with regard to everyday policing that they encounter?
It's a complicated answer. Here in Minneapolis, we have one of the largest populations of urban natives in the country, and so for my entire lifetime at least, there has been a well-earned skepticism of police and police interactions. Dr. Williams went into some of that history of policing, Minneapolis police within Native communities as well as Black communities. And, I recall in the early 90s, a series of interactions with Minneapolis police and some Native individuals from our communities. One that stands out, two Native men being transported and driven around in the trunk of a Minneapolis squad car by police. And so there is the healthy skepticism, but I think
are you still hearing stories like that? I mean, stuff like
not,
that.
Not currently. to that extent. But I think it goes back to what Mary Lagarde was saying, is these efforts of community and public safety really being taken up by community organizations and forming those relationships with Minneapolis Police Department. We don't hear, those as many of those kind of brazen offenses as we have heard, but
Do you think that's a sign of progress, or do you think that's just anecdotal evidence that we may or may not have access to?
Gosh, I like to look at it as a sign of progress. But there again, I have my own skepticism about interactions with police. I mean, I have too many stories, from personal stories, too many stories from family members, things like that. But I like to think, and I hope that we can mark it as progress.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a fear with, what's happening at the national levels and Trump administration about what might happen to any progress that has been made over the last 5 years.
Well, let me ask you more about that with regard to the current presidential administration. And is there any sense that what we're seeing here is backlash over what happened related to George Floyd?
I think we can certainly mark it as backlash. People who have been doing racial justice work, we often speak about whiplash, racial whiplash, and how any kind of steps forward or progress that is made will have a reaction to. And in many ways, I think Donald Trump's first administration was a backlash to having our first black president, President Obama, in that. And I think we are, there's always a kind of backlash that comes. And I think in Trump's second term, we are just seeing an emboldened disregard for the basic humanity of black and brown people.
I want to ask you about current Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara. He's publicly opposed the DOJ consent decree, referring to it as detached bourgeoisie liberal mentality. What do you make of that criticism? And how do you approach education on racial justice with people who share that viewpoint?
Yeah, it's that is incredibly disheartening. I attended George Floyd's funeral in 2020, and I have a distinct memory of following the casket out of the auditorium and seeing Chief Arredondo, the then police chief of Minneapolis Police Department, and a number of his officers actually take a knee as the casket of George Floyd came out. And there's a certain skepticism of this being kind of empty symbolism, but at the same time, it takes an acknowledgement and a certain humility to stand there in uniform and to bow your knee in reverence and solidarity. And it's rather disheartening to hear Chief O'Hare's comments to this effect. And I think it is kind of counterintuitive to, it is counterintuitive to what is needed in terms of, if we're going to find a path towards, as Dr. Williams said, policing from a public safety standpoint, or even as Mary Lagarde brought in this idea of more community policing. And I know that Minneapolis Police Department actively tries to recruit new officers from the Minneapolis Native community, and those kind of comments and that kind of walking back some of the hoped progress, I don't think it doesn't serve MPD well, and it certainly doesn't serve Native community at all.
Do you know about how many Native officers serve on the Minneapolis Police Department?
I don't. I wonder if Mary
Can you help us out there?
I don't know.
number of sworn officers, Native American sworn officers?
I was trying to get that number, I don't, but so I kind of have a guess. It's a handful, and one of those police officers is actually one of my relatives. So I know there's at least one then.
Okay. What do you hear from your relative who's a police officer there? And is that person able to patrol in some of the Native areas in town where there are high populations?
You know, we don't talk about work that much. I see him at, at family gatherings now and then. That officer, he is an officer now. In the 3rd precinct, and that is the precinct, that burned, a few years ago, and that's the precinct he's in, and so he is patrolling in our community because our Native community, a lot of the residents live, in South Minneapolis in the 3rd precinct.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, so we're going to have to wrap up this conversation. But I appreciate our three guests who joined us today, Mary Lagarde, Yohuru Williams, and Reverend Jim Bear Jacobs. Join us back here again on Monday when we mark Memorial Day with a conversation with Vietnam War veterans, 50 years after that war ended. And on Tuesday, we get updates from fast-moving changes in federal support for education and low-income services. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Andy Murphy and Sol Traverso are our producers. Joe Thompson is our UNM Local News Fellow. Marino Spencer is the engineer. Sho McPoland is the digital producer. Nola Daves Moses is the distribution director. Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our national underwriting sales director. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor for National Native News. Charles Sather is our chief operations officer. The president and CEO of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. Have a safe weekend. I'm Sean Spruce.
Trickster Cultural Center, an authentic first voice of Native American veterans and cultural arts, will host the 2025 Pride Celebration honoring diversity through Native drum and dance, artistry, resource exchanges, and vendor fair. Trickster Cultural Center's Pride Celebration is open to everyone at no charge June 7th from 2 to 7 p.m. in Schaumburg, Illinois. More under events at TricksterCulturalCenter.org or at 847-301-2090. Trickster Cultural Center supports this show.
Support by AARP. Despite their service to our country, U.S. military vets, active duty service members, and their families are targeted by con artists significantly more than civilians and are 40% more likely to lose money than civilians. Vigilance is our number one weapon against fraud. You have the power to protect yourself. If an offer sounds too good to be true, it probably is. More at aarp.org/vetsfraudnetwork.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.